Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9 to 5 for a 5 to 9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Service is not available in all areas.
Yeah, I think Keon has been focused, dialed in. His agent and I have developed a good relationship. You know, he's actually kin to Keon. And so I think he was very blunt with him as well, just off of some of our conversations. And Keon can take it. Like, for a young man, I give him a lot of credit. Of course, anybody can take praise. It's not easy to take criticism. And he took it unbelievable. And that's the thing I tried to stress to him when he got back, is you did a lot of positive things. Don't focus on just the things that we want to see improve. And he's worked hard. He's been here the whole time. You know, you can see when him and Josh were here, they're forming that rapport and kind of picking up where they were pre-injury last year. So I'm excited where he's at.
Bill Shim, Brandon Bean from minicamp wrapping up at the end of last week. Good morning, Jeremy and Joe. Keon Coleman took that criticism to the basketball court and dropped 60 in a charity game, dunked on everyone, rained threes. It was impressive.
See, the threes are like...
step back.
Watching him play football, him dunking isn't like the craziest thing to me.
It was still impressive.
Him hitting a step back three and it just looking as clean as it does is the thing that's crazy to me.
60 points in a charity game.
He had 40 at the half. I bet he probably
he dialed it down.
Didn't he probably leave some for the others in the second half?
He might have. Joining us on the Western Hotline, we've got a lot to get to with Matt Bove, friend of the show. You know Matt Bove from It's Always Game Day in Buffalo with Sal Capaccio and, of course, sports director WKBW. He joins us on the Western Hotline. Little U.S. Open and also something, an exciting thing that Matt's got coming up on KBW as the weeks go on from here. Matt, good morning.
Morning, gentlemen. Thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it.
Did you see the Keon highlights of him going ham on everybody on the court?
I always just get a little frustrated that there are people on this planet who are that good at multiple sports. I feel like if you're going to be really good at something, just let everybody be really good at one thing. To have people who are that good at multiple sports just seems even more unfair than it already is.
I mean, don't you think there's a good chance he's the best basketball player in the NFL?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, the fact that he played college basketball has him
right
in pretty elite company with the league. He's definitely up there. He's definitely in the top five. But there's probably some guys who are in the NFL who are so good at football that they never even considered playing basketball, mm-hmm, who are probably just also absolute freaks as well. So, yeah, he's definitely one of them. Like, it's just, I did see the highlights, and it's just like, this is absurd, like, that this guy can do this stuff.
One of the things, like, a quick search of athletes, NFL players that played college basketball, it gets to mostly guys that were just kind of, I don't know, they were in college. Like Donovan McNabb was not quite a walk-on, but he played at Syracuse on that team. He's with that team a little bit. Or, I mean, Antoine Randall-El.
I think of the tight ends over time, right?
Sure,
like Antonio Gates. Jimmy Graham. Like, every year, I feel like there's a new tight end in the NFL where, like, oh, this guy played basketball at, you know, wherever.
Yeah, Julius Peppers played in North Carolina, averaged 7 points per game.
Mm-hmm.
So you get some. With Keon, it's funny, Joe was saying, like, step-back threes versus the dunks. The dunks show you that above-the-rim kind of skill set that he has, and they use that a little bit, Matt. I wonder if you feel like there's more there, more above the rim stuff from Keon, because I tend to think that they could do that a little bit more if they want to.
I think the game that we should look back on, and it's tough because it's easy, it's a layup, no pun intended here, but the Seahawks game last year was his most impressive game because we saw a little bit of everything. But yeah, that going up and getting it above the rim, I think about the play that they had. He had a touchdown in the corner of the end zone. On the play before, they tried it, incomplete pass. They went back to it again, and then after he made the catch, he slapped Woolen on the head, like, good try. I'll get you again later in the game or something. Just kind of, like, almost embarrassing him. It was a really impressive play, and I think that that's what they've always wanted to see out of him, and they just didn't have that when he came back. I think that's the plan. I think for him, it's like a go be the guy who can make contested catches, who he can throw it up. There was another great example later in the year against the Jets where Josh just bought time, rolled out to the side, and just threw it straight up in the air, basically. And it was either going to be an interception or he was going to trust his guy to get it, and Keon Coleman came down with it. So they need to see strides from him in year two. He's definitely a player who is important. I think there's other players who are more important, but a big step from him would go a long way.
Matt Bove joining us on the Western Hotline. Before we get to some other things, one of the reasons you're joining us today is because you are starting a new retrospective series that begins tonight. So tell us what's going on WKBW.
Yeah, so tonight we are starting a 7-part series. It's going to start at 7:30. It's called Leading the Charge, 52 Years of Fandemonium. This has been something we have been working on for months. And listen, we're going into the final season in the stadium. This is going to bring out a ton of emotions for a lot of people. As we were starting to think about our plans for how could we say goodbye to this building, we were looking at the schedule, and I'm like, you know what? When we get to the fall, we're going to be spending most of our time talking about football. It feels like we really need to carve out some time to say goodbye to this place and share some stories. And we're right in that window now where up until training camp, there's not a whole heck of a lot going on from at least a Bills standpoint. So we have been interviewing former players, current players, staff members, fans, just anybody who has a story with that stadium to try and have them kind of take us down a walk down memory lane. So the stories have been incredible. We are super excited to put together. We kind of have 7 episodes, and each one of them focuses on something a little bit different. Like tonight's episode, the first episode, is much more about the early years at the stadium, and you'll hear from people like Joe Ferguson and Joe DeLaMalier, and there'll be some Marv Levy and Jim Kelly mixed in as well with some fans and all that kind of stuff. And then as we get further into the series, we'll kind of get back to where we are now and hear from some of the current players about their most iconic moments. But the thing that has been so impressive to me is that everybody I've talked to, I've tried to ask a couple questions that overlap. And one of them is just, what is your favorite memory or your favorite game inside that stadium? And it has been very surprising to hear how different some of the answers are. I thought going into it, it was going to be a lot of the comeback game and a lot of 51-3. And there was a ton of that. But it's really cool to hear people or watch them kind of process it in their head and go back and be like, this is my favorite game. Yeah. Or they share a story about why it's their favorite game. And then you get to the point where people have just broken down in tears because they're thinking about who they were at that game with, if that person's not there anymore, why they care about the Bills so much. So it has been a very emotional experience. So I'm really excited to see it all kind of come together.
If going all the way back to the opening of the stadium, was there any sort of conversation you had about how it was at the time, whether state of the art or how big it was? Because, you know, now building stadiums is norm. It's very normal, and they build these great palaces. But I wonder what it was like the day it opened and how awe-inspiring it would have been in that time.
Oh, I've got so many stories about that. And that's why it was perfect to talk to Joe DeLaMalier and Joe Ferguson. So they carpooled to the game together. Their first preseason game, that's when the Bills still had training camp at Niagara University. It was a night game, and they left at noon because they were like, listen, we want to go and be there as early as humanly possible. But then when they got down to Orchard Park, they got stuck in traffic for like an hour because it was also the Erie County Fair. And they were like, who plans the start of the Erie County Fair on the same day that we were opening a new stadium? This seems a little bit Bush League. But they talked about walking into the building and it just being this palace. And then Sal Majorana from the Democrat and Chronicle, he's somebody who will be on the episode tonight too. He was also at that first game. The perspective he shared, the scoreboard at the time was $1 million. And then $1 million was unheard of for something like a scoreboard, considering the rock pile didn't even have replays. So for the small little grainy replays to be there at the stadium, and it's funny because you go through, we've been going through all the WKBW archive video of some of these games, and you're seeing all the stories about what it's going to look like in the locker room and what it's going to look like in the stands. I mean, compared to the rock pile, it was a palace. And these players realized that, and they say for a good 10 or 15 years, they felt like they had the best stadium in the NFL. Now, you know, it's a stadium that's got a lot of character. I don't think anybody would call it the best stadium in the NFL, but it's funny because 50 years ago, it probably was one of the nicest stadiums in the league.
Yeah. I think I learned about how they used to do replays recently on the scoreboard and, like, blew my mind. Like, it doesn't even look like video, like how they would do it, like, up until maybe even the mid-90s. On scoreboards,
really?
Like, I don't know. I forget how it was described to me. The other thing I'm realizing Matt, because I'm hearing you talk about tonight's episode, and I'm excited because I like hearing about, you know, there's pre-90s teams, because we hear so many stories about the 90s. And you'll have, like, I know, like the goalposts came down, and there'll be a million good memories. I guess I'm just realizing that there wasn't a playoff game played in that stadium for the first, like, 16, 17 years of its history. Like, 89 is the first time you have to go to get a playoff game at that stadium, which is pretty wild.
Well, so, and to your point, I'm 32. I'm from Western New York. I've been here my entire life. When I started the idea for the series, I literally just took out a pen and paper and started writing down names of people who I wanted to talk to. But it's incredible, almost the disconnect from somebody who's even in my job and who is from here about the years before the Super Bowl era. Maybe those are just so big that that's what we immediately go to. But I'm looking at the page and I'm like, I feel like I'm missing like almost 15 years of Bills football inside that stadium that I need to make sure that I address. And then you start to think about, like, the name that came to mind was Jack Kemp. And I'm like, oh, wait, Jack Kemp never played in the stadium. Like, he only played in the Rock Pile. So who were the guys who opened the stadium? And honestly, a lot of it is the OJ era. The 70s are pretty much all the OJ era. So that was kind of what the big story inside that building was for all of those years. And then there were a couple guys who surprised me at how long they had been here. Like, one of the people we'll talk to during the series is Daryl Talley. Like, he started playing for the Bills in 1983. I didn't know that. I thought that he was kind of a later 80s guy into the Super Bowl year. No, he was there for a couple years where they weren't very good. And then, obviously, once you get to 85, they've got that great draft class, and then they continue to kind of build off of that. So this will be – tonight's episode especially will be much more about kind of like the early years. And I think that, for me, it was very informative just because there was a lot of stuff I didn't know. Like, did you guys know – do you know the first play inside that stadium for a preseason game? Do you know about this?
I do, but I only know it because I would have looked it up like somewhere in the last like month or two. But go ahead.
Jeremy, do you know?
I don't.
The first ever play inside the stadium was a kick return touchdown against the Bills. Like, doesn't it feel like that really set the tone for the last 52 years of Bills football?
Yeah. Yep.
So, Matt, when you're talking to, whether it's old timers or current players, you know, there's the nostalgia of saying goodbye to the stadium. Is there a feeling of excitement even among all of them about the new stadium?
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Yes, for sure. Definitely. It's mixed, though. Like, I say yes, for sure, definitely, because that is kind of the thing that almost everybody ends with, but how excited they are for the new stadium. But there's also a little caveat that they all put in there of, we're very excited for the new stadium, but we really want to make sure that it still has the energy and the atmosphere that we have at the current building, just because, you guys know, you've been around to a lot of different stadiums. It's not easy to replicate that. I know the fans are going to be a lot of the same people, right? A lot of the fans who are going to be there for the last year this year will also be in the stands for the first year next year. But it's just making sure that you can get that energy and that home field advantage. Now, from like an actual technical standpoint, the sound is going to be incredible in the new stadium, and the way that that place is going to trap the sound under that canopy, I think is going to have this place be really loud, and everybody's kind of right on top of the field. So I think that will help. But like, the atmosphere at a Bills game now is so unmatched. There are a couple stadiums in the league that are anything like it. Arrowhead is like it. Pittsburgh is a little bit like it. Lambeau's like it. So for what we have now, it's so unique. So, yes, I think there is just we're really excited to see this new building because the fans deserve it. This is going to be so incredible for the fans, but we need to make sure that Buffalo continues to have the home field atmosphere and advantage that they currently do. So that's kind of the typical way people have explained it to me.
Which is a big part of the story and, you know, kind of plays into the history of the stadium. Matt Bove joining us, sports director at WKBW, also does the Always Game Day in Buffalo podcast with Sal. 7-part series about the final year at Highmark, the history of Highmark Stadium as well, that starts on Channel 7 tonight. So, all right, the next part of what I want to get to, Matt, is how about the drought years? Because, you know, those are not exactly glory years. However, I feel like there's a strong case to be made that those are the years that the mafia really forged itself to be what it is. And that's why when this version of the Bills that plays in the stadium comes to be, they got a full army behind them pretty much from day one.
Oh, for sure. That, to me, is the years that I immediately think of. As somebody who's my age, I remember going to games during the drought, whether I was in high school with my dad or whether I was in college with all my buddies. We even had season tickets for a couple of years. And it's funny, because for as terrible as the drought was, there are some incredible games, for good and bad reasons, just kind of mixed into the drought. And that's a lot of what this series is going to highlight, is those moments that you were like, wow, I can't believe that happened. And a couple of the players who were like, wow, like, I can go back. We didn't talk to him, but when I think about the drought, like, a random name that comes to mind is Roscoe Parrish, right? And you're like, okay, I could think back to the Roscoe Parrish punt returns during the drought and watch those on YouTube and just start my morning that way. But it is funny, because that is the start of Bills Mafia. And this fan base has always been very passionate, but it really elevated to its credit during those years, and then was ready to kind of take on the spotlight that comes with having a great team. So yeah, the drought is definitely going to, there is an entire episode about the drought that's coming in a couple weeks, because it's a big part of Bills history. And it's crazy that after they played their last playoff game in the 90s, there wasn't something again up until the 2020 season in Orchard Park. And then that year was COVID. So there was only like 7,000 people there.
Yeah.
And that also leads us to why, now once again, this is a little bit of a tangent, why some of those playoff games in the years after the COVID year were so spectacular. Like, a very common answer that I got was the Patriots playoff game in the wild card round. That being one of the best, that's Josh Allen's answer. That is his best moment in that stadium. If you ask him, what's your favorite game you've ever played in the stadium, that is the one that goes to him. And there's a lot of people who would feel the exact same way. Because even though it's not the same, the magnitude isn't the same, it's kind of our generation's 51-3. Like, there was really never a doubt in that game. That was a celebration by the second quarter, where the 51-3 game was a celebration to go to the Super Bowl, which is also just crazy to think about, that they won an AFC championship 51-3. It's just bananas. But yeah, the Patriots game is a very common answer for people.
I would imagine the three answers. Are there any others you got other than the Patriots playoff game, the 51-3 game, and probably the comeback game? Like, that probably would be almost everybody's answer, I would think.
31-0 over New England on opening day was a great one. Like, for me, that's
31-0 was an answer that got brought up a couple times by people, because it felt like a lot of people thought that was back. A common answer is specifically with, like, their favorite play. It was not a full house by any stretch, but a lot of people brought up the Taron Johnson pick six against the Ravens as their favorite memory inside the stadium, and a couple players felt that. A couple people, I think this is a hint of recency bias, a couple people brought up the Patriots game after the DeMar Hamlin situation, and I think because of the start of that game, like, how magical that first play was. So that was a game that had gotten brought up a lot. A couple people brought up some games from back in the day, like early Monday Night Football against the Raiders in the mid-70s, and how good the Bills were then. There's a lot of games that have gotten brought up. Oh, and then even a couple people brought up the Patriots game during the drought that they beat in week three.
Yeah.
Like, that's another game. And then the week before that was the Raiders game, where they also erased a huge deficit. So, like, there are some, I would say, answers that a lot of people had, but then there's like five or six games that we didn't even talk about that people gave answers to, and then they gave reasons why.
Did the 6-3 Browns game come up?
You know what? I remember where I was for the 6-3 Browns game. I wasn't at the stadium, and I just remember thinking to myself, like, why are we doing this to ourselves?
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing? Like, why am I watching this football game?
Oh, I'm sure you got to it at some point, but, or that maybe somebody mentioned it, but just because of the sheer weather, I mean, the snow game against the Colts in 2017 is an all-time day at that stadium.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, absolutely. We have had a ton of people who have referenced being at the stadium that day and watching the progress from what was supposed to happen pregame to all of a sudden before kickoff, them not being able to see a thing. That's been cool, too, because I've had a chance to talk to a lot of the players who have, like, been on the team for this era, and them going back to days like that, like McDermott talking about that. Sean, I talked to Sean for a while about this, and he actually shared some incredible stories about the stadium too. So there's a lot of cool perspectives. But the snow game, then you start to think of the names in that game. Joe Webb, Deontay Thompson, Nathan Peterman starts the game. Calvin Benjamin has a touchdown in that game. Like, there are some very fun names to look back on from that day.
Matt Bove on the Wester Hotline. The series starts tonight on Channel 7, a retrospective seven-part series looking back at Highmark Stadium. Matt, before we let you go, a thought on J.J. Spaun in the U.S. Open?
How cool was that? What an ending. That was so awesome. Like, listen, I love golf, but I also love watching elite players win. Good for J.J. Spaun. I like to see the underdog story. And also the way the leaderboard played out, I'm happy that he was the guy to get the win of the other names on the leaderboard. I was kind of pulling for a Scotty comeback over the course of the day, even though it became pretty apparent early on that that was not going to happen. I just admittedly like when an American wins the U.S. Open. I always think that's cool. But the way he did it was really, really awesome. Yeah. And guys, first major with a lab putter.
That's right.
Like we're on the verge of something here.
Yep, that's right. Can I tell you the thought I had when he made that putt? Like, after watching 10 replays, this is going to be a random thought, and I don't know if anybody else thinks things like this, but I think you'll easily identify with this. That putt from 64 feet and making it like that and the reaction from the crowd, the thought I had was, if you did that in front of a wedding party on a random Tuesday, it would have the same reaction. Like, that's what golf does, is like, hold on, let's see this. Oh, we made it! And the place would go nuts, and it wouldn't have to be the U.S. Open, because it was just, so much of that reaction, I think, is, sure, he won the Open, but the actual shot itself is just like very organic, kind of like, whoa, the guy hit the ball from really far in the hole, and that was pretty cool.
We did my my stag party before I got married, like 5 or 6 years ago, at a golf course, and there was a putting green in the front. And one of the things we did was we charged $5 for three putts, and it was like a 75-foot putt. And whoever made the putt first got whatever the prize was. I think it was like a pair of AirPods. And you had just like 75 people standing around the green watching everybody do their attempts at this. And I was, believe it or not, I was the first person to make the putt. And you could have made you could have thought that I just want to make
right.
reaction of just the celebration of, oh my God. And I did give the AirPods back, by the way. My thought watching the putt last night, because you've seen all the different angles this morning, was, if it doesn't go in, I feel like it's a slippery distance and it's not a gimme.
Yeah.
Like, it's coming in with a little bit of pace. That's my mind of like, oh gosh, like that would have been a terrifying putt to try and win the U.S. Open. So for him to do it the way he did, I think everybody's probably happy about that.
Yep, very much so. Matt, thanks for the time, and looking forward to seeing the series.
Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate you having me on.
Matt Bove, sports director at WKBW. It starts tonight, 7:30, Channel 7's series, looking back at Highmark Stadium, a seven-part series, so check that out. Paul Hamilton, when we return, we'll get his thoughts on the latest reporting on J.J. Paterka, whether or not the Sabres can be pushed to do this and trade him. If that's what's going to happen, if an offer sheet could happen, we'll get to Paul's thoughts on that as we approach the start of the NHL offseason. The draft is just 11 days away. Jeremy and Joe on WGR.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.